Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this week's edition of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. Coming up on today's show, we've got a look into convenience stores and how pandemic buying may have affected convenience stores as Casey's announces their quarterly earnings. We'll also talk Chewy and pet sales, how the push towards online sales affected Chewy for the good and the bad, and a quick story from Sam's Club, as well as looking ahead regarding California retailers that might be in a bind as a result of a bill signed into law a few months ago. Our interview guest, the fantastic Nikki Baird. She's the VP of Retail Innovation at Aptos. She joins us to discuss the debate and dilemma for some retailers regarding perhaps mothballing inventory, especially as it pertains to apparel, selling it off at a discount, selling it off to an off-pricer. They've got a number of different decisions to make, and they have to make all of it before buying starts really for the fourth quarter. So she gets into details regarding that, as well as some historical perspectives. She's been in retail for a while. She goes back to 2008 to pull up some historical reasons why businesses might choose to do what they do. It's a great interview. Stick around for that. Additionally, you can like us, rate us, however you find us, whether that's on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podcast Addict. The list goes on and on. If there's a podcatcher, we're probably on it, and you can like us or rate us if you enjoy us on that platform. One other note, you can also check us out on social media at Retail Podcast on both Twitter and Instagram. So we start off with Casey's. It's one sector that we haven't really talked about yet regarding pandemic buying patterns, the convenience store sector. And we got a very important look inside the recent sales cadence of C-stores with Casey's General Stores earnings this week. The vast majority of C-store operators are private, as we know. So Casey's earnings calls, always valuable to give us insight into the industry. For those that don't know, Casey's has over 2,200 locations, mostly in the Midwest. So the upper Midwest on into the Great Plains, a lot of smaller markets there. The overall premise of their call seemed to be Casey's adaptability. And Darren Rebel, as their CEO, said from the start that their flexible business model would enable them to navigate certain waters as the pandemic wears on. A quick couple of notes before Leighton gets to the numbers. They kind of divide things into three categories. Fuel, which we'll talk about a little bit, but not a ton because we're more focused on retail. They'll look at grocery and other merchandise, and then prepared food and fountains. So they break things down into three categories, and that's important to keep in mind as we get to the numbers.
Yeah, and as for those numbers, this was actually for their fourth quarter. We should keep in mind that the quarter ended on April 30th, so in most of their markets, we're talking about around 6 weeks of pandemic impacts overall. As far as earnings per share are concerned, Casey's did post a slight miss, coming in at $1.67 per share versus analyst expectations of $1.83. Beyond earnings, they posted same-store sales declines of 2% in grocery and other merchandise, Trent talking about those categories. Honestly, this was much better than expected, and much better than we expected personally, given that they aren't really the type of business to attract pandemic buyers. Although they posted, and they've been posting, increasing sales geared towards fresh food, their pizza proposition did allow them to both stay open and drive traffic in some of their markets. Same-store sales in the first half of the quarter were up, consistent with the rest of the fiscal year, where comps were up over 3% coming into the quarter. They noted that across both in-store categories they have, the same-store sales were up mid-single digits through the first 2 weeks of March, even excluding the extra day for leap year. Once pandemic conditions set in, they did see some momentum in shelf-stable merchandise, much to the chagrin of their bottom line, as that merchandise doesn't come with as high of a margin as some of their grocery product does. Total sales in grocery and other merchandise were up 1% year over year due to entirely the unit growth that they've had. This compares to a 5.5% increase for the year as a whole. Their gross profit did decline 2.4% year over year, owing to those in-demand, low-margin products that we were just talking about. but prepared food and fountain took the biggest hit, which is really no surprise. Same-store sales in this category were down 13.5%, although average margin remained strong at 60%. This is where you see huge margins with convenience stores. On a dollar basis, total gross profit from this category was down 12.8%, again, with unit growth helping to slightly offset comp declines. Rebelez blamed traffic declines for this, but mainly restrictions in most of their markets that prohibited food self-service. You think of all the pandemic regulation, a lot of which was either mandated by the state or the companies themselves saying that the customers should not touch certain common areas. And categories affected by this included their growing soft serve ice cream endeavors, which were especially impacted as the weather turned warmer in the latter part of the quarter. However, they were helped slightly by their continued digital build out regarding pizza and other foods. And overall, those sales, Trent, were helped given this whole very, very ominous pandemic situation. So customers were able to pre-order food in some markets. This was especially important for small market stores where they were the only restaurant still open in some cases. To this end, they saw double-digit growth in whole pie sales as opposed to single pie or single slice sales, which took a hit. They noted that higher commodity costs, driven in part by panic buying and other areas of the food world, shaved down margins somewhat towards the end of the quarter. A quick note regarding those fuel sales, their average margin on fuel set records in the quarter. This was driven by the dramatic drop in wholesale fuel costs, which were well documented by the media in February and March. Same store gallons dropped 14.7%. largely as a result of stay-at-home orders, people just not driving as much. Despite this, margin of 40.8 cents per gallon allowed their gross profit dollars from fuel to explode by 96% to $198.8 million. Initially, when we read 40.8 cents per gallon as the average margin on fuel, we thought this was a misprint. It was even higher in April at 63 cents per gallon. However, comically low wholesale prices combined with customers' acceptance of paying a certain amount per gallon provide massive profitability in this area. Still, to put this in maybe a larger perspective, the $198.8 million was still behind their gross profit dollars from grocery, merchandise, and prepared food and fountain sections, which indicates how little most convenience stores actually make from fuel, considering record margins here for Casey's.
Yeah, so once again, just to summarize, you look gross profit from fuel way up. Numbers in terms of gross profit or margin per gallon that we have never seen, basically, in terms of fuel sales. But grocery and other merchandise gross profit was slightly down as a result of those lower margin categories being the ones that sold. And it was way down for prepared food just as a result of not being able to sell as much prepared food. All of this led to Casey's still outperforming last year's fourth quarter on the earnings per share front. You look at $1.67 per share in terms of earnings this quarter versus 68 cents per share a year ago. So nearly a dollar increase on a per share basis. And that's with other things going on, you know, share buybacks and the like, but it still fell short of analyst expectations there. Depending on where you look, we cited $1.83 earlier on in the story, but we saw some consensus estimates, Zach's consensus estimates ran as high as $1.97. So still a miss on profits, and their overall profitability was hampered just slightly by an increase in operating expenses. Although this is where things kind of get interesting and why we wanted to look at this earnings call to see just how much convenience stores were able to temper staffing as needed. Their fourth quarter, Casey's, that is, saw far lower operating expense increases versus the prior quarters of the fiscal year. So what we're saying here is operating expenses for Casey's coming into the fourth quarter were already up. This as a result of an expanded store base. So you were looking at increases in the 8 to 9% range as far as their overall operating expenses over 2018. Now, for comparison, operating expenses were just up 6.2% in the fourth quarter of this fiscal year over last fiscal year. As a whole, the fiscal year saw a 7.7% increase. So that kind of paints the picture there of how little it increased in the fourth quarter versus some of the other quarters. And they were able to save incrementally as a result of a reduction of staffing due to COVID-19 related opening hour reductions. They weren't open as long as what they typically were. Their stores were closing earlier and opening later. As a result, you saw staffing cut back, and they were able to save money on that. They also saw lower credit card fees, which was unique given most retailers have reported customers going away from cash at the point of sale. Although in Casey's case, when you look into it, this appears to be born out of negotiation and just paying less on a per swipe basis versus an actual decline in the number of swipes. And although they noted some cleaning expenses due to COVID, their same store operating expenses, so you're looking at the stores that were built over a year ago, their operating expenses were actually down 2%. So the reduction in staffing expenditures more than made up for any of those COVID-related costs due to cleaning or other measures taken inside the store. Same store labor hours, as an example, were down 10.3% across the entire quarter. So same store operating expenses down 2%. Hours for the employees were down over 10% year over year, and of course, a bigger drop towards the end of the quarter, of course, there. Now, one other note regarding the business as a whole in terms of numbers and such, they made no move to suspend share repurchases or dividends, although it is important to note no share repurchases happened during the quarter they were reporting on. Now, one thing that we did come into the call wanting to hear about was Casey's expansion plans. And every time we talk about Casey's on the show, we talk about their expansion plans, their aggressive expansion in years past through acquisition and also growing organically. That's been a constant topic surrounding them. And we came into the call wondering, you know, we've heard other retailers, even really successful retailers, talk about how their growth is throttled a little bit by the pandemic. Five Below, Dollar General, among them, saying, hey, we might not be able to grow quite as much this year as we have in years past. Now, for reference, we talk about Casey's growth. Casey's added 61 net new stores in the last fiscal year, so that's net of closings. That's down a bit for them, but still fairly robust. Of those additions, 18 came from acquisitions. They ended the fiscal year with 2,207 locations in total. So that's one of the largest C-store operators in the country, despite their limited footprint. They're not coast to coast, again, mostly in the Midwest and the Plains. But I think what was interesting is they haven't in any way put the brakes on their expansion plans. They remain bullish with a new store pipeline of 93 total sites and 24 currently under construction. So they're already looking at potentially more openings for 2020 than they had in 2019, looking at the fiscal years, of course. Not all of the 93 are likely to open in the next fiscal year. Just because they have a pipeline there doesn't mean that they would be set to open in the next 12 months, but it does represent a likely increase of that organic store growth over fiscal 2020. They did have to temporarily suspend some construction as a result of COVID. But mostly, again, here because stay-at-home orders rather than financial restrictions for them. Nothing has been restricted indefinitely related to COVID. It's just a matter of construction crews maybe not being able to get out and do the work. Now, despite these obstacles, they were able to complete 6 openings in the quarter. They're also under agreement to purchase 2 stores from other operators in the very near future. Now, again, Rebelez underscored the fact that they plan to keep expanding mostly through organic growth in the near future. So we're not going to see that mix tilted the same way we have towards the acquisitions. But he said, you know, we're not going to rule out any acquisitions if the right opportunity presents itself. However, all this uncertainty surrounding COVID, surrounding openings in their various markets might mean that they'll be slightly less bullish than previously in terms of acquisition. Still, it was refreshing to hear a retailer talk about not throttling back their growth plans, looking to keep those growth plans in place.
Looking through the call notes, they did provide more clarity on the call itself, breaking down specific categories. For example, they noted that grocery and other merchandise sales were up over 5% for the first 6 weeks for the quarter before tailing off dramatically due to the pandemic conditions. However, and we found this interesting, beer and tobacco were both resilient during pandemic buying conditions, remaining strong even as same-store grocery and merchandise sales were down 9% over the last 6 weeks of the quarter. Although this doesn't necessarily prove anything, it does suggest what we've been hearing from retail insiders, that many of the categories that are typically considered resistant to economic downturns, like alcohol and tobacco, have been so during the pandemic. And you see that a lot of people are questioning maybe some of these stores or outlets remaining open while others have been closed during the pandemic. And people wondered actually about tobacco, given the increased emphasis on lung health during the pandemic. But at least for Casey's, tobacco sales have been consistent. Prepared food and fountain, however, as noted earlier, saw the greatest pandemic impacts. Indeed, during the last 6 weeks of the quarter, same-store sales were down approximately 30% in this category. This despite their efforts to have customers pre-order pizza and other food digitally. Despite their whole pizza sales being up year over year, as noted earlier, this category does make up just 25% of the historical prepared food sales. So while this category is up significantly, it has not made a dent in the losses experienced from the rest of the category. As Casey's noted, municipalities clamping down on self-service offerings, including those fountain drinks that are also popular. And in fact, because there were so many areas that prohibited self-service products, Casey's suspended self-serve operations chain-wide for a period of time. They did note that recently, including May and June, which aren't included in the numbers here on the call, they've been able to reopen these parts of their stores while maintaining the double-digit percentage increase they've seen in the whole pizza sales. In fact, they've mentioned that over 50% of all pizza orders are digital for them now, which of course allows them to collect consumer data in ways not possible before this digital push. However, this view into the convenience store industry's handling of the first 6 weeks under COVID conditions paints a brighter picture than we were expecting overall. We figured that the drop in prepared food and beverage would be maybe more harmful than it was actually proved out to be. Additionally, although convenience stores weren't the epicenter of panic buying, it is apparent that they saw some benefit from increased grocery sales to offset lost sales in other categories despite lower margins. It was the unprecedented fuel margins that allowed them to have the quarter they did. We'd wager some other major operators, maybe like Couche-Tard, Come & Go, and Quick Trip, saw similar trends as well. And honestly, Trent, throughout me still driving some places, I've noticed convenience store prices for gasoline still pretty high in some areas where you would think that the demand, especially in Southern California, is probably 50 or 60% less than it was just 3-4 months ago.
And again, that comes back to the C-stores being able to charge a certain amount for gasoline. So even though the product itself might be close to free, they know they can command a price of however much. I think it was down to $1.30 in some places here in Colorado. So they know rather than charging 80 cents per gallon, they can charge $1.30 per gallon and pocket that additional 50 cents. So we saw wholesale fuel prices certainly help out C-stores and help to wallpaper over the losses they might have seen from those in-store sales. And I think a lot of C-store operators, we know, of course, from historic data, but also from common sense, that C-store business picks up in the summer. They might be a little bit more throttled here this summer because not as many people taking those road trips, getting out on vacations, a lot more people doing the staycation thing during the summer, and there's less financial flexibility as well. So we still don't know how that's going to impact the C-store industry, but positive signs, I think, from Casey's overall in their numbers that they were seeing throughout May and June. They referenced them slightly on the call. They didn't give complete numbers, of course, for what they've seen since the quarter ended April 30th, but I think it's not a disaster, not a train wreck by any means for the C-store industry, at least when you look at Casey's numbers. Well, coming up after this break, we'll have a discussion with Nikki Baird, the VP of Retail Innovation at Aptos. Nikki will join us to discuss decisions as far as inventory retailers have been collecting over the last several months, and also why discounting might not be the best option for a lot of these retailers. Well, we've started to move the focus of our interview segment from the data that has happened in terms of pandemic buying and the like to what will happen or what could happen in retail over the next several months as things shift into kind of the new retail state. And to that end, we're pleased to be joined by Nikki Baird today. She's a former managing partner at
RSR Research
and was a principal analyst at Forrester Research, which is, if you're unfamiliar, really one of the heavyweights in the field. Currently, Nikki is the VP of Retail Innovation at Aptos, and she joins us to discuss the new future of retail coming out of the pandemic. Nikki, thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So first, just so our audience knows kind of the perspective you bring from the retail industry, I gave a bit of a blurb about your background, but I was wondering if you mind discussing a little bit about your background, what Aptos does on the day-to-day, and then maybe a little bit about your role there at Aptos.
Sure. So I usually characterize my experience as I've done everything that you can do around retail technology. I have been at a retailer implementing point of sale and back office and some order management, a small retailer located here in Colorado. And I went from there to the IT consulting world. I helped retailers select and implement technology solutions. I went from there to the software world where I ran marketing and product marketing for different software companies. And then I joined the analyst world. And as you noted, I was a principal analyst at Forrester Research, and I left there to co-found a boutique analyst firm called RSR Research. And I encountered Aptos while I was there, and the company was doing some really interesting things that I thought had the potential to really impact the future of the retail industry. And so I joined up, I drank the Kool-Aid. Aptos is an enterprise software company, and we provide solutions that focus on customer experience in retail, as well as enabling on the product or merchandise lifecycle side of the house as well.
So long story short, you've basically been involved in retail some way or another for a while, but you've also been involved in retail in a number of different aspects, which I think is refreshing. You don't talk to a whole lot of people that were maybe working at small retailers before moving into the analyst platform. And so we wanted to kind of touch on some of that expertise today. One of the things that really stuck out is that it's been well documented that sales, especially in apparel and specialty retail, suffered mightily in March through May. We all know that. Yet, a lot of their supply was still coming in. So I wanted to touch on supply chain first. What kind of challenges and decisions are retailers facing as far as inventory and supply chain now is concerned?
Yeah, the whole spring season basically was frozen because of the shutdowns, because of consumers who were just not buying, understandably so. And then retailers, you know, the supply chain, especially for fashion and apparel, is very long. So putting the brakes on that is really like trying to put the brakes on a freight train. Yeah, you can get it to stop, but there's still going to be a lot of train cars that kind of pile up over the line before you finally can get that thing stopped. So retailers had a lot of really difficult decisions to make about what to do with the stuff that's not selling, what to do with the stuff that you cannot stop from coming in because it's already on a boat or it's already, you know, paid for, cut and sewn and dyed. There was lots of rapid decisions that retailers had to make. And it's going to impact already the summer season. But I think the one that worries everybody the most is how is this going to impact fall and winter?
And I think it's interesting kind of using the apparel example and that freight train example. You know, a lot of what we were hearing before the pandemic is retailers were very proud of the fact that, oh, we're instituting monthly turns or biweekly turns of merchandise. Well, now that all has caused somewhat of a backlog of merchandise. So what type of decisions now do retailers have to make resulting from this backlog of merchandise?
Yeah, so some of them are looking at either packing up merchandise. So some people are calling that mothballing. Some are calling it pack and hold. And so literally the inventory that you have no chance of selling because we're either going to get too far into the summer season or maybe even turn towards fall, they're looking at packing it up and storing it until spring of 2021. Some spring merchandise never actually ever even made it into stores. So this idea of packing it up, it's not as extreme as it sounds because it was never unpacked in the first place. The downside to that is the holding costs. So you're piling more cost on top of this inventory than it already had on it to get it to where it was in the first place. And then you've got all of this inventory is effectively money. It's cash flow that the retailer needs to spend on the next season and the next season. And so it's basically like sticking cash in your freezer and just waiting until you're going to pull it out again next year. And given the financial results, the performance that retailers have had over the last couple of months, that's not an easy decision to make. There's not a lot of cash just laying around.
And so we look at the mothballing aspect of it, or the pack and hold aspect. You talk about, obviously, the opportunity cost there of keeping that merchandise around because you're taking up that room in fulfillment centers and the like. From a technological perspective, what are some of the technologies that are out there that can help retailers make a good decision on whether to pack and hold merchandise and take up that space in the distribution centers, or maybe sell it off as a closeout to an off-pricer?
Yeah, so off-price is definitely an easier place to be these days if retailers do make that decision. But from a technology perspective, the planning solutions are the ones that are getting the really heavy workover right now. So normally retailers manage their inventory against an open to buy. So what have I sold? What do I have coming in? And what's left over in dollars that I can put against kind of new inventory purchases to make sure that I hit my sales goals? That whole calculation has just gone completely out the window. Nobody knows what their sales goals ought to be. They certainly aren't the things that we anticipated when we first set our plans for 2020. The amount of inventory that's on its way that can be canceled, that can't be canceled, that's still an ongoing, you know, kind of evolution. And then, you know, the margin dollars that you're potentially going to get from selling this inventory, also highly questionable. Am I going to sell this at unexpected markdowns? I think, you know, during the depths of the month of April, we saw retailers pulling out the kinds of discounts that put Black Friday discounts to shame. And those were definitely unplanned discounts that retailers had to take. So there's a lot of pieces at play. Complicating it even more is, how much inventory do you really need? Which stores are open? What's the capacity of those stores? Some of that changes on a weekly basis. You've got states and local governments that are setting rules that change from week to week, that they're promising that if things go wrong, they're going to throttle back even. So just even keeping up with which locations are available for me to ship to, which ones need inventory, is calculus of a whole new kind that retailers have to face.
Obviously, a lot of variables floating around out there. And you mentioned something that we hadn't even talked about beforehand, which is the retailer's own decision to maybe have markdowns in store rather than packing away or selling to an off-pricer. They could mark down in store. To that end, how do you see things perhaps shifting on the retail front if retailers decide to go more towards that route in terms of, you know, again, kind of keeping the technology bent there as far as how they make those decisions and where they find the right prices to do so?
Yeah, you know, the markdown question is a really tough one. So when I was at RSR, that was during the time of the financial crisis that happened in 2008 and 2009. And we ran surveys of retailers the whole time, asking them lots of questions about consumer price sensitivity and things like that. And what we found coming out of the financial downturn was that retailers got hit hard. You know, 2008 and also 2009 were really tough holiday seasons for most retailers, and they had to take heavy discounts that they weren't really expecting. Well, the price sensitivity of consumers, at least as reported by the retailers themselves, lasted about 4 years after that. So the discounts that they took in order to make it through all those consumers kind of pumping on the brakes during the financial crisis, it had multi-year impacts. And I think probably my biggest concern just in talking to others in the industry is that lesson seems to have been completely forgotten. So there seems to be a lot of confidence that, oh yeah, I can just take some markdowns. If I discount all my stuff, I'll be able to move it out. And as long as I'm relatively cautious and give myself some flexibility in what I buy for the winter, then I should be totally fine. Well, everybody else is making that same calculation. And you have also all these retailers who were financially troubled coming into the pandemic, who now are filing for bankruptcy and closing massive amounts of stores. So, you know, they're not going to take cautious discounts. This is, I'm discounting it until there's nothing left. And you've got to compete with that while you're trying to, you know, balance margin and make enough dollars that you can buy holiday season or spring 2021. And so that environment just does not look like that's stacking up to be very favorable for retailers who want to heavily favor that discounting kind of strategy.
And that's a great point, too, because discounting kind of plays into that consumer expectation, therefore, of lower prices going forward because they get used to that type of thing. I did want to shift gears a little bit because you wrote a great piece, a very insightful piece, just regarding the changing role of brick and mortar and the brick and mortar store as far as retail is concerned, that we're seeing kind of a shift away from that being the core focus of retail. We were wondering if you could discuss a little bit of what you're seeing surrounding that shift in importance of brick and mortar there.
Yeah, you know, I think some people interpreted that as saying, oh, it's the death of the retail store. And I just want to be clear, that is not the case. Like, the store is such a critical part of the retail enterprise that while it may not look the same going forward in the future, it's still going to play an important part of the role that the retailer plays in a customer's life. I mean, the challenge is we've always been, or at least for the last 20 years with the rise of omnichannel, we've been struggling with how to redefine the role of the store. When digital plays a greater part in consumers' lives, then the role of the store is smaller than it was before because digital has kind of taken over some of the activities that consumers used to do exclusively in a store, like research products, for example. So that idea that the store can be the same as it was coming into the global pandemic, that definitely is a very risky perspective to take. The store was already experiencing an enormous amount of change. And a lot of what's happened has really just accelerated some of those forces that were already in play. So will there be fewer stores? I think particularly when you talk about North America, there already were too many stores. So some of these store closures, while they're impacting, you know, iconic retailers like JCPenney, for example, they are evidence of something that was already happening, that was already there and in play before the pandemic hit. And then, you know, will stores be smaller? Probably, because, you know, we don't need the selling space that we needed before. Even with fewer stores, you know, we might need more space for inventory fulfillment, for example, to happen out of that store as opposed to something that you're trying to ship from a centralized distribution center. So retailers before the pandemic, they were struggling with, you know, how do I integrate digital more firmly into the store experience? How do I integrate that store experience more firmly into digital? And things like live streaming and, you know, setting up video chats with customers who are at home, talking to employees who are in a store who can walk around with a camera and show off products and things like that. The pandemic has really accelerated retailers' considerations of some of those activities, but, you know, they were honestly were activities that were already in play. But I do think, you know, that we're not going back to any kind of normal. It already wasn't normal before the pandemic. And we've just seen an acceleration of the trends into a very concentrated period of time that stores are going to have to grapple with as they reopen.
You touched on a few different things that I kind of wanted to follow up on. First is, of course, the shrinking square footage. And I don't think there's a lot of argument to be made that, you know, a Kohl's needs 150,000 square feet or something like that to exist. But, you know, we saw a few retailers recently, one of them being Dollar General, last week released earnings. And they said, hey, our brick and mortar footprint was important because we've got these small stores, but we've turned them into, you know, FedEx centers and grocery centers, and we found ways to play with it a little bit. Is this something that, I know no one has a crystal ball really, but is this something that we might expect other retailers to do, is maybe open up more stores, have a greater brick and mortar footprint? They're just all maybe smaller and geared more towards fulfillment and service.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've seen these dark store concepts. Some people are calling gray stores now, where they have maybe like a very small selling floor footprint, and then the whole rest of the square footage is devoted to fulfillment. You know, one thing that we were encouraging retailers to think about before the pandemic hit was to look at a region and think about stores from the perspective of a portfolio. So it's not that you're going to have 10 stores in an area and they're all going to be exactly the same and they're all going to serve the same function. You might now have 8 stores in this area. One serves as, you know, almost like the flagship of that area, or region. And then you've got 7 satellite stores that are either highly localized or serve more forward positioning of inventory functions, where you can use them as these gray stores or these even dark stores, and all you're doing is fulfilling goods to customers.
And that's kind of where I wanted to bring it all back to the technology as we wrap it up here, because you know what you just mentioned, that's a model that, you know, AutoZone to an extent, O'Reilly to an extent, has used in certain markets. But again, how can the technology help retailers make sense of that portfolio to where they realize, hey, some of these stores might be better used to other purposes, not necessarily closing them all together, but maybe with a different overall footprint in mind?
Yeah, you have to really, there's a couple of pieces to it, right? First, you've got to digitize your business. If any of the data that you need in order to make these decisions lives in somebody's Excel spreadsheet on their laptop or under their desk, then you're already starting from a much harder place to answer these questions than anybody else, than if you've got this stuff in systems that you can access. So I think from one perspective, the pandemic, one of the interesting side effects was, you know, as retailers closed their headquarters, they sent everybody to work from home. And for some people with manual processes, or amazingly enough, paper-based forms, or people are emailing spreadsheets to each other, that became really difficult to sustain when nobody was in an office together. So I would say that's the first part of it, is that you've got to have digitized processes to support inventory, to support labor, and to support kind of store performance. And then you've got to pull all of that together to really analyze across different silos, typically, of the solutions within the business. You've got to bring online and store sales together. You've got to understand where your customers are shopping, not from a physical perspective, but are they buying this kind of thing online? Are they buying something else in stores and there's no crossover? Or, you know, how do they divide up kind of their omni-channel behaviors, and how does that apply across product categories? The more digital your business is, the easier it is to ask those questions and get answers.
Fantastic insight. Well, once again, Nikki Baird, the VP of Retail Innovation at Aptos, thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, we thank Nikki once again for joining us. A fantastic interview, a lot of great insight, and we just thank her for getting beyond the buzzwords. As we say, we always love it when an interview guest breaks down things in real terms, and Nikki, fantastic job of doing that, and hopefully we can have her on the show again in the future. Well, we move on to the pet space. Both Layton and myself have pets around the household, and we have some macro data suggesting pet owners are buying online more than ever. We've talked about that on previous shows, but the online shift due to the pandemic didn't necessarily show up in Chewy's bottom line as Chewy's released earnings this week. Chewy has gotten away with losses to this point based on their kind of long-term process that promised that they will eventually bring profits to shareholders, but their earnings miss and loss per share raise some eyebrows in the retail world. However, I think it's important to look beyond that. When you look into the loss, it wasn't as bad as first indicated on the retail front. Still, we did expect a few better numbers maybe from Chewy on the whole. The call was for their fiscal first quarter ending May 3rd, 2020. So we're looking at around 7 to 8 weeks of pandemic buying conditions here when you look at the footprint that Chewy has. Really, some of the pandemic buying from Chewy started in early March. We talked on a recent show about Nielsen data, by the way, surrounding pet sales. We know that sales of pet food tailed off in April, the food itself, after panic buying in March, but other categories like treats and accessories remained strong into late spring. That's why we were so excited to talk about this earnings call and look into it. And as we so often do, we begin with the numbers for Chewy.
Let's talk about that loss first. Analysts still expected a loss of 11 cents per share. Chewy narrowly missed with a loss of 12 cents per share on an adjusted basis. However, the net loss of $47.9 million included share-based compensation expenses of around $42.3 million. They're paying their employees well during this downtime, but granted, these were actual costs for Chewy, so it isn't like it's an impairment charge. It's more of an incentive charge, if you want to look at it maybe in a brighter light. Still, when you remove the $42.3 million here, things are looking a lot better for Chewy just on the retail operations front. And if you look at the sales numbers, which is the real reason why we're here at the end of the day, we're here to talk about Chewy's growth in sales. Their net sales came in at $1.62 billion, which was a 46% increase year over year. Their gross margin on that sales number was up slightly, 50 basis points to 23.4%. We've talked in the past that the company felt as though there was an additional capacity under their slate of expenditures that they could take advantage of when sales did increase. Economies of scale, if you will, basically. The slight improvement in gross margin was part of this, but also eroded somewhat by cost related to upstaffing and other COVID-19 measures that they've had to implement over the past few months. Specifically, filling out their freight and logistics systems led to a positive impact of 120 basis points on gross margin. They also noted their increased private label penetration, which is extremely important for almost any company, but especially Chewy here, which did lead to a 60 basis point contribution to gross margin expansion. Active customers were up significantly year over year, slowing a slight boost sequentially from the fourth quarter of 2019 as well. They currently have around 15 million active customers, an increase of 3.7 million over the end of last year's fourth quarter. And I now am an active customer. I have to admit, I have a cat that's sleeping now beside me during this recording. So on a percentage basis, they did see the fastest acceleration of onboarding new customers in the company's history. So it's very interesting. Their marketing efforts are really making headway, but then also I think it's word of mouth. Chewy's platform is impeccable, in my opinion. An ongoing topic for Chewy has been auto ship or subscription sales. And we wondered to what extent the pandemic would actually affect this, considering many were going week to week and evaluating their household needs. Auto ship sales account for well over half of their overall revenue. Overall, auto ship sales were up on a dollar basis, totaling $1.1 billion in the quarter. However, they were down as a percentage of sales sequentially. In the fourth quarter, auto ship sales accounted for over 70% of their overall revenue. This is likely due to the influx of new customers, perhaps trialing Chewy before they wedded themselves to the service itself. More on these new customers' buying habits in just a little bit. But you look, some of it is probably due to the nature of consumer buying in March and April, where customers focused on things in waves. However, it was noted by Singh that the auto ship signup and cancellation metrics from their new customers was roughly in line with past years. As far as the pandemic-based impacts go, the main focus of CEO Sumit Singh on the call was providing flexibility for Chewy employees during the last 3 months.
Yeah, and although those employees in fulfillment centers, obviously it makes sense that they're required to physically be at work, Chewy was able to move their customer service representatives to 100% work from home role by the end of March, which was probably good for their work-life balance, considering the volumes that the Chewy customer service representatives were dealing with during that time. Although Singh did mention on the call that the volumes have moderated somewhat, you can imagine the influx of calls and inquiries they were getting surrounding the first wave of pandemic buying in March. Now, while the first quarter was defined by the pandemic, Chewy did carve out a little bit of time, at least, to roll out a few other initiatives they had in the works. One specifically was gift cards. It's kind of stunning that they didn't have digital gift cards to this point, but they did note a pretty high adoption rate for them already after rolling that out. Singh did spend a good portion of the call talking about consumer insights they were able to gain from the quarter's buying habits. And this is one of the things I like about Chewy's calls, is because Singh is so good in terms of kind of lifting the curtain, talking about their internal data that they've got. And yeah, of course, most of the data is going to be a little more positive. You're not going to release negative data necessarily on a call if you're Chewy, but still, it gives us a bit of an eye into how people are buying pet products at this point. And the nice thing for us is we were able to kind of compare and contrast these numbers to the numbers that we saw from the greater macro from Nielsen in regards to pet buying. Now, Chewy divided their customers into two cohorts. They have a pre-pandemic cohort covering really the year prior to the pandemic, and then a post-pandemic cohort covering the 2 months that they have data for after pandemic buying started. So this allowed them to kind of isolate the buying habits of customers who joined Chewy during the pandemic, they found that of the 1.6 million new net active customers added during this time, initial orders, so the first order by a new customer, was up 11% versus new active customers added during the prior year or the year prior to when you saw pandemic buying really hit. So this tells us that those first-time customers are spending more. Now, is that a result of stockpiling and pantry stocking? It's difficult to say, but it does indicate that these new customers weren't just replacing their store trips one for one for pet essentials during this time, because that's what was happening the prior year. Instead, they were showing some of the same panic buying habits that accompanied those in-store pet product purchases. Additionally, this is something else that I found interesting and certainly a positive indicator for Chewy over the next 6 months. These new customers that they got, the 1.6 million new net customers like Layton, for example, that they got, they were more likely than the prior year's new customers to make a return purchase in the 4 weeks following their initial purchase. So they were more likely to come back within 4 weeks than those customers that they added in the prior year. And not only were these second purchases more likely, but they also tended to carry a ticket size that was about 5% greater than some of those pre-COVID second purchases. Again, maybe partially due to the stockpiling habits, but overall, people seem to be more willing to spend on their pets during this time. Now, Singh did note that baskets for customers during the pandemic were generally larger with a greater mix of consumables. And again, Singh said, hey, we think it's due to the pantry stocking, stockpiling, whatever you want to call it. It was also reported by grocers and other pet retailers. And in fact, when you dig into the numbers for Chewy, they saw an increase in consumable sales that provided an additional $70 million in sales during the quarter. And we talked about that Nielsen data to open the story about how consumables, particularly pet food, sales were way up in March and then down even over last year, April 2019, when you look at April 2020. That was not the case for Chewy. And I think this is perhaps the most astounding figure. They've yet to see that $70 million sales benefit from those additional consumables reverse like the rest of the industry has. They don't expect a reversal going forward. It hasn't happened for the 3 months or so after March. They've made it this far without seeing a backing off. So they expect that to just be, hey, $70 million in straight benefit and an opportunity to win some of those new customers. And finally, I think this is the most interesting aspect of what was talked about on the call, not necessarily the most interesting data, but the most interesting information that we got had to do with the supply chain. Singh said that Chewy was not unlike other retailers, of course, where the panic buying in March without the ability to prepare inventory stores like what they have leading into the holiday season led to more out of stocks and suboptimal inventory levels than they would have liked. Still, they felt as though the negative impacts from the out of stocks were mitigated somewhat by their recommendation engines. Layton talked about how he really enjoyed shopping Chewy's site. The recommendation engines were providing basically substitute goods for out of stocks while those items were out of stock. Still, some customers stuck with ordering those out of stock products, knowing they weren't going to get it for a certain amount of time. What happened was that this resulted in a greater number of split orders because fulfillment on the out of stocks had to wait until, of course, they came in stock. But if the person ordered four or five different things, two or three of the things shipped in one wave, the other two or three shipped in the second wave. And so, as you might imagine, this forced greater shipping costs because multiple boxes had to be shipped. And it's not only the cost of shipping, but also the cost of boxes and the cost of fulfilling multiple orders, basically. As a result, buyers on the back end, they had to scramble to fill the out of stocks or backfill those, really. And that resulted in a slightly higher cost of goods sold in certain circumstances and for certain brands. Not only that, but the company was forced to fulfill some of those out of stock orders once they got the product in. They had to fulfill them from DCs, basically, that were further away from the customer. So if a customer ordered something in, say, Florida, it might have had to come from the Phoenix distribution center, the Phoenix area distribution center. So that forced greater shipping times and costs. And in fact, to ensure that delays were cut down somewhat, They leveraged express shipping on certain orders, which cost them further. All of this added up to a major reason behind why gross margins, which we talked about to begin the story, not expanding by a greater amount, because shipping costs were about $20 million above what could have been expected in the quarter. Now, they hope they have seen the worst of this by now, and they're adding an additional Pennsylvania distribution center to be open later this year. That's kind of expected to ease the burden of their other 9 DCs as well. But something that was mentioned on the call, and just something to keep in mind, is really what impacts attrition might have as far as their employee base. Now, they've worked their employees a lot over the past 3 months, especially those fulfillment center employees. They've had to add 6,000 staff. How many of those 6,000 are going to stick around, knowing that there were probably some overtime calls, there were probably some really difficult work times for those employees? But overall, kind of putting a bow on the whole thing, we saw from Chewy that the benefit of more people staying at home and buying digitally might not be that big time victory for e-commerce that some analysts seem to believe. Now, you do have an unprecedented opportunity to win new customers, but there's a number of tangible and intangible costs that come with this sudden influx of orders that's coming all at once. We're not talking about a gradual scaling up of these orders, but an influx of orders all at once. We'll see over the next 2 years how many customers stick around. At this point, it's kind of up to Chewy to ensure that these customers continue to buy, but it's also important for all of us to keep in mind the additional costs that are incurred when we do see influxes of orders. And it's also something to bear in mind as people start to talk about a potential maybe second wave of the virus and a second wave of closures as well. Well, we wrap up the podcast news segment with a quick final story as Sam's Club announces the nationwide rollout of curbside pickup this week. The announcement came Thursday, was widely carried. You saw it over most major news outlets throughout the country. Big caveat here, though, is that the service in the future will not be available to all Sam's cardholders, just some. Now, let's talk about those details. This is a program that had been trialed in 16 Sam's Clubs for the better part of the last several months. They made the decision to roll it out to all 597 clubs after what they called positive feedback from families and businesses. Now, the program will only be for Plus members in the future. Plus memberships run $100 at Sam's versus their typical club memberships of $45. One of the things that I found important to note, only one member of a household can be a Plus member. That is to say, there aren't Plus member add-ons available. Another person in the household could buy a second Plus membership for another $100. But unlike their club memberships, there aren't add-ons available when it comes to those Plus memberships. And Leighton, I'm going to turn over the rest of the story to you because I know you really love this space. You're intimately familiar with the goings-on here at Sam's Club, and we want to talk about how the program works and potential future impacts.
Yeah, it's going to be sort of a new entry for Sam's Club. They've been, as you said, Trent, trialing this in 16 stores so far, but it's going to be sort of hard logistically because historically for Sam's Club, they used to have fax and pull. Now they have click and pull where you could pick up orders that were fulfilled by store employees. This is going to be a little bit different because it's going to be somewhat what Walmart and Target have been doing. So it's going to be a little bit different because the products are different. They're larger in some cases, and it looks as though the platform optionality is going to be a little bit different. Orders can be scheduled for pickup between 7 a.m. and 8 p.m. Monday through Saturday and to 5 p.m. on Sundays. And we keep saying that the program will only be available to Plus members in the future. That's because it is temporarily available per Sam's Club remarks to all members. They're saying that they're trying to do as much as they can to help their customer base during this time of pandemic. So COO Lance De La Rosa said in a prepared release that this is because members increasingly are looking for contact-free delivery. And I think, honestly, Trent, it's going to be really a focus for them, a huge point for executive teams to try to roll this out for their entire member base. And to me, the big question would be, why didn't you just say that you're going to have it in perpetuity for all members? If you could do it now, when you're just now rolling it out and maybe times are the toughest to do something like this, just have it available for all of your members, because people at Target that don't pay an annual membership fee that's equivalent to $45 or $100 have this kind of service too. So it's one of those things you have to look at. Again, their product assortment is a little bit different, so maybe that comes into play here. But this is overall a helpful mechanism to allow SAM's members to trial the service. The hope, obviously, is that customers may upgrade then to the Plus memberships once the curbside service is no longer offered to just those entry-level club members. And honestly, Trent, it is going to be interesting having to convey that to those customers once they stop having it available for non-Plus members. It's sort of like bad news. How do you express that? Because they didn't give an explicit timeline on this release at samsclub.com. So I think it's going to be very interesting, not only that, but then also the logistics of it. Because right now, each individual Sam's Club location has already built out an area, typically at the front of the store or near the front of the store, that puts all of the click and pull items, all of the online orders where you can pick up at the store, that again, the orders have been fulfilled by store associates. They keep building out these areas to make them larger and larger and larger. And so soon you can envision a store wherein maybe 10 or 15% of the entire footprint is for fulfilling orders that customers have placed either online at samsclub.com or on their app, the Sam's Club app. So it's very curious to me how they continue to do this, but they've had several iterations of those areas within the store. Some areas have actually taken over where tobacco centers used to be because they have to have so much space for items that people are ordering online that are for frozen goods, for cooled goods. So they need space for new freezers and coolers up front as well. I think it is going to be sort of a logistical nightmare, but the hope is, and I think maybe the reality is for Sam's Club executives, is that those 16 stores proved the concept here and to be able to streamline operations for those customers to have their orders fulfilled, have a contactless delivery to them when they pull up to the store in their designated time frame. And I think to this end, Sam's Club overall has been funneling a lot of money, and they talk about this on earnings calls, into their app. And I think since this is just an extension of the app, it's going to be beneficial for them to roll this out to the customers that are already familiarized with this app. From what I've seen, this application looks extremely similar to the other areas within the app already. So customers are going to be familiarized. They're going to pick their day. They're going to pick their time slot. It's all supposed to be fairly seamless. The one thing I should note, though, however, is that the store associates should be prepared, ready, and trained up for this, because this is an entirely different service. This isn't just putting the items that you bought in a cart. It is making sure you designate which items are for this particular service and which items are for the contemporary or conventional service that they had previously. So that's an important caveat, and I think it's going to take time to not only train those associates, but it's going to take human capital expense. The store is going to have to know that they have to set aside funds to pay additional hours, human hours, for that type of cost. So with that, I hope that this works out. This is something that we're going to see, I think, and not only the Target and Walmarts of the world going forward, but all of Sam's Club's competitors. BJ's is rolling out something similar, we've been hearing, and then also Costco as well. Trying to get things right is a huge thing for Costco. Typically, with Sam's Club, biggest competitor in Costco, you'll see a company that is very, very careful with trialing things out. You see it with self-checkout. They'll only do a select few clubs before they really roll it out to the rest of their clubs, and they do so in such a methodical way. They would probably do something similar with something like this as well.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We've reached the final segment of the Retail Focus podcast, a segment we call Looking Ahead, where each Leighton and I take a story that we're keeping an eye on over the next week, month, or year. I'll go first. You know, in this role, we put together this podcast. We've been doing it now for 5 years. We read a lot of different industry publications, a lot of different industry magazines, A lot of them might be a little bit segmented, for example, hardware retail or pet retail. And I was reading Garden Center Retailer magazine here recently, their June 2020 edition, and their cover story actually covered something that I found to be quite interesting. And one of the interesting facets that we're starting to see from independent garden centers now is a You Pick, We Plant service. And in addition to that, which is a We Plan, You Plant service, basically people can buy an entire slew of plants at a garden center, and the garden center will either do it themselves or contract with landscapers to actually plant those particular plants. Now, this is starting to carry a little bit of momentum as people, of course, not wanting to leave their houses, maybe to go to a garden center to pick things up. So garden centers are beginning to move options online, and they're putting together kind of pre-packaged selections of plants. The reason I'm looking ahead to it, first of all, kind of speaks to the fact that people don't want to get in the garden maybe as much as what they once did, or they want that one-stop convenience maybe for putting those annuals in place. But the reason I'm looking at this is, hey, independent garden centers are seeing a little bit of momentum towards this. Is this something we begin to see in terms of Home Depot, Lowe's, Menards, Ace? The list goes on and on. Is this something that other stores that are not independent begin to install and have available? Much like if you buy an appliance at Home Depot, they contract with a third party to come and install it, usually, and haul away the original one. Are we going to see similar types of services in the garden center for these retailers? But more importantly, I think a lesson can be learned from the kind of We Pick, You Plant option, or We Plan, You Plant option. So it's not necessarily a situation where customers aren't planting it themselves. In this circumstance, you're looking at pre-assembled packages of plants. Kind of like, you know, if you go down the chip aisle and you see those Doritos mix packs or what have you with the different types of Doritos in them. It's kind of like that, only with plants. And are we going to start seeing more of that? You know, you already see hanging baskets at these major garden centers. You already see some other selections. Is this something that they're going to do on a merchandising level? Oftentimes, garden center merchandising is done through partnerships with the likes of Burpee or Monrovia or Bonnie or any one of those vendors. Is this something that vendors are going to start picking up on? So that's the reason I'm looking ahead. You know, it's the time of year where the garden center is often very busy. Are they going to start to prepackage things together for consumers, making it easier for them to either buy those products online and pick up in store, or make the shorter shopping trips there to where they don't have to think about kind of their own landscaping decisions? And more importantly, are those planting services going to be available at the major retail stores? I think there's a lot of innovation yet to be had in the garden department, because this is really an area where we haven't seen buy online, pick up in store, or any digital options come to fruition.
Well, my looking ahead story has to do with, again, the pandemic, but then also regulations within California that are forcing certain retailers in the home improvement space to keep a margin at or below 33.3%. I think this is going to be interesting because there are ongoing talks with certain areas of the retail industry, such as the North American Retail Hardware Association, that have urged the governor, Gavin Newsom, to work alongside retailers to get to really a solution, an area of compromise that states that this should be maybe a little bit higher. So the rule right now states that if a seller did not sell a particular item, or even if they did prior to February 4th, that certain items listed under maybe more essential goods within a retailer have to be at or below a 33.3% gross margin. And as we know from doing the podcast and looking through tons of earning reports from the likes of Lowe's and Home Depot and Ace Hardware, that gross margins a lot of times will actually be above 40% during normal conditions. So a lot of retailers are saying that they can't pay rent and the additional COVID-19 protocols if they are to keep their margins below 33%. Not only does it not pay your rent, it's hard to pay those employees that you're trying to keep employed through this pandemic. And I think it is completely valid. It's an extremely valid argument. And I think maybe the compromise would be somewhere between 50 and 60%, considering the extra costs of logistics and making sure that your point of sale stations are well sanitized, you're having to spend more on time and employees. I think it's only fair to reach some sort of middle ground here with state representatives. But I think overall, Trent, the story here is there's no real oversight as to the creation of these executive orders. So we're talking about just one state here. But if you're a large retailer such as Home Depot that does business in nearly every state, you have to abide by each executive order or each protocols that are given out in each municipality. And it's going to be extremely tough to really make sure that you have streamlined operations when you have to abide by a whole different set of rules in each area. I think it's extremely difficult, and it's even more difficult for those local establishments that don't have the resources and the time and the capital up front that a large retailer such as Lowe's or Home Depot do already from previous quarters of success. So I think this is going to be very interesting. I think there needs to be oversight, logical, sound oversight on some of these executive orders, because a lot of representatives, I hate to say it, they don't have a retail background, they don't have a business background, and they certainly don't know the specific financials of each individual company, as certain products have a large margin, some don't, but it's all planned out accordingly within the business model, and it's almost like reverse price gouging here, where you're implementing a price fix for certain retailers on certain products that's more or less arbitrary to a certain degree and has no such reasoning stemming from supply and demand metrics. But curious to see how this pans out so far, Trent. The organization that I mentioned, the North American Retail Hardware Association, has reached out. They have a formal statement, and they even make it known that, you know, a lot of times for these retailers, the net margin, so after you pay the rent, like I said, after you pay the employees, after you pay the additional expenditures for all of these coronavirus protocols, you would be lucky to get around 3, 4, 5% net margin after it's all said and done. So just merely looking at the gross margin of 30, 40, 50% on certain products, it's not fair to the retailer because they have a ton more overhead costs that go in to just the general cost of doing business that is really paid for by those double-digit gross margins, which, again, now they're being told that on this wide range of products have to be below 33.3%.
That's great insight, Leighton, and hopefully they can work things out to where retailers aren't losing money hand over fist in what's already kind of a difficult retail environment coming out of the pandemic. Well, that'll do it for this week's show. Once again, a big thanks going out to Nikki Baird, VP of Retail Innovation at Aptos, for joining us. A big thanks to you as well for listening, and we'll be back with you 7 days from now.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.